Good morning. Coming up on 740 here on the Mighty 690. It's a Wednesday, so that means we get to talk with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We will be talking with James Coover here in a little bit, but right now we have online horticulture agent Jesse Gilmore. Good morning, sir. How you doing?
Good morning. Hope everyone is staying cool as the temperatures are supposed to be baking.
They sure are. It's going to be a hot one. We're looking at 101 for Coffeyville heat index, maybe up to 107. That's where we got to yesterday, so it might even be a little bit hotter than that. So, yeah, it's a hot time for people, pets, and, of course, plants. And I know that's something that we always seem to talk about when we have you on. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, I guess weather plays an important part in the development and production of fruits and vegetables and the like. But we're not really going to be talking about the weather much today. There's probably going to be a little bit of weather talk, but right now we're going to be talking more about tomatoes. And one question in particular that people have been called in or been calling in about recently, and that is blossom end rot, which we didn't really see a ton of last year. So I'm not surprised we're getting calls about it. Because it can be a problem. Just compared to last year, we are getting so many more calls about it. So something about either the weather or the nutrients in the soil, or both, is causing a calcium problem in these tomato plants. Blossom end rot is actually not a disease like it looks like and like most other rots are. It's actually a cause of or it's caused by the plant being unable to take up calcium from the soil. And usually this is not going to be because it is deficient in the soil, because our bedrock is limestone. And limestone chemically is just calcium carbonate. So when the limestone breaks apart and weathers in order to form the soil, it just turns into calcium and carbonate. So there should be plenty of calcium in the soil. The plants should be able to take it up with no problem. But paradoxically, with calcium, the more calcium there is in the soil, if you have too much calcium or an excess of calcium, it can actually limit calcium uptake, which is like the opposite of what you would expect. But plant nutrients and soil chemistry work in very strange ways sometimes. For the people who have called in about blossom end rot, I don't know that this is the case, but after doing some research on blossom end rot, it turns out that calcium and magnesium have an antagonistic effect on each other in the plant. So if you have an excess of magnesium in the soil, like, for example, if you put Epsom salts in the soil with the tomato plants, magnesium is also a macronutrient like calcium is, and for tomatoes in particular, magnesium is very important because it develops fruit flavor. The more magnesium that the plant has access to, the more sweetness that the fruit is going to have up to a point. But over applying magnesium can have negative effects on the plant's ability to take up calcium, and then you would end up with blossom end rot. So as with all things nutrient related, a balance is necessary. But blossom end rot is a rot on the bottom of tomatoes and sometimes peppers as well, but primarily we know it as a tomato problem. It's on the bottom of the fruit because that is where the blossom fell off from. So it is the blossom end of the fruit instead of the stem end, hence blossom end rot. So we mentioned that blossom end rot is calcium related. And that calcium should be present in the soil in high enough quantities to not have blossom end rot occur for the most part. One thing that has been pretty interesting about the blossom end rot questions that have called in is that there seems to be a common thread of applying mushroom compost. We can't confirm that the mushroom compost is what's causing the calcium to be unavailable to the plant, but it's an interesting commonality between the blossom end rot cases. And with mushroom compost, if the mushrooms in the compost are still alive, they could be binding to calcium, or they could be using the calcium themselves instead of allowing it to go to the plant. So that is an interesting variable that I had not considered before, but could be causing the increase in blossom end rot in some of these cases that are calling in. Now, calcium is responsible for root growth. And so one way that you can kind of visibly tell what your calcium levels are like in the soil, well, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be what your calcium levels are, but one way you can tell whether or not your calcium is getting up into the plants in other plants that don't have blossom end rot is to take a look at the roots. So pulling the plant out and gauging the root growth compared to what you would expect for a plant of that particular size. And if the roots seem underdeveloped, you have some kind of calcium issue. That could be the calcium is not present in the soil in high enough quantities, which would definitely be surprising, or the plant is being inhibited from taking up that calcium that is already in the soil, which is much more likely. Some people will amend the soil with eggshells. Eggshells are a great source of calcium and pretty easy to get your hands on since a lot of people, you know, eat eggs. You don't want to put full eggs in the soil, just the shells. Some people will also soak eggshells in water and then after a certain amount of time pour that water on the plant. So it's like a liquid fertilizer of calcium, which will much more quickly affect the plant than if you just put the eggshells in the ground and wait for them to decay. Calcium is a positively charged nutrient in the soil, which means that it is going to bind to clay particles and be held in the soil much easier during watering and rain. So it is not something you would need to fertilize with very often, if at all, especially if your soil is more clayey. Clay, in general, binds to any positively charged nutrients. So things like potassium, magnesium, calcium, all of those are going to be held by clay in the soil. So the likelihood of deficiency for calcium and magnesium goes way down the more clay that you have. What else? There are 17 total plant nutrients that the plant needs to take up, 14 of which it needs to get from the soil, the other three being carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, which it gets from water and carbon dioxide. So you don't need to provide those three. But the four nutrient deficiencies that I run into the most in vegetables and fruits and trees is nitrogen, potassium, iron, and magnesium. Now, the tricky thing about learning to identify nitrogen, magnesium, and iron deficiencies is that they are pretty much all going to be the exact same symptoms. You're going to see yellowing of the leaves. Which leaves you see yellowing is going to differ. So that is one way to tell. But just at a glance, nitrogen, iron, and magnesium all show pretty much the same symptoms. Iron and magnesium, nitrogen is a problem because we typically run low in nitrogen. Usually when we get heavy rains, it falls down through the soil profile because it's a negatively charged ion, which is not held by clay, like positively charged ions are. So nitrate leaches through the soil profile really easily, and we're typically deficient in it anyway. So nitrate, that shows as intraveinal chlorosis. So if you look at a leaf, the space in between the veins on the leaf is yellow, but the veins are still green. Iron and magnesium are the same way. The only difference between the three is which leaves are affected. So mobile nutrients are going to show their deficiency symptoms on the lower leaves first because those nutrients are being moved up to the tips of the plant, whereas immobile nutrients are going to show on the tops of the plant because it can't move up as far because it's more immobile. I believe, although I'm not 100% sure, that iron is an immobile nutrient and that nitrate and magnesium are both mobile. But if James is listening and he knows differently, I would go with what he says. In other crops, like for field crops, for example, you might see the occasional boron deficiency. I think that usually when it occurs in things like soybean. But we don't typically see that in specialty crop production or in trees or turf. So iron and magnesium are both incredibly abundant in the soil. The plant will have as much as it needs in the soil already, so you will never need to fertilize for iron or magnesium. Now, that being said, people will put Epsom salt into planting holes for tomatoes because it does increase the flavor, but it's usually not going to be necessary. Iron and magnesium, because they are present in enough quantities in the soil, there's going to be something else that causes the inhibition of uptake, and that's going to be a high soil pH. pH is a scale from 0 to 14 on the measure of acidity, so versus alkalinity. 7 is perfectly neutral. You've got a balance of both hydrogen and hydroxide ions in the soil. If you add a hydrogen ion and a hydroxide ion together, you just get straight water. So hydrogen is a positively charged ion. The more hydrogen you have, the more acidic your soil is going to be. And hydroxide is a negatively charged ion. The more hydroxide, the more basic your soil is going to be. Once you get up to pH around 7.5, which is pretty common for most of our soils, then you start seeing the hydroxide ion bind to iron and magnesium. And once the hydroxide is bound to those two elements, the plant can't take it up anymore. So the way to fix that is to go about adjusting your pH with something like elemental sulfur or coffee grounds, anything that is going to bring more of a balance to the pH. That'll free up some of the iron and the magnesium.
Gotcha. So if people have, you know, continuing questions about maybe if I'm assuming that, you know, blossom end rot is usually pretty characteristic. I mean, is there anything else that does kind of the same thing that's actually going to be something else, or is it pretty much only one thing on that?
Well, you can occasionally see rot on tomatoes that is not associated with a calcium deficiency, but the location on the fruit where the rot occurs is going to be the telltale sign. If it is on the bottom of the fruit, that is 100% blossom end rot, and that's going to be calcium-related. Anywhere else on the fruit, you can assume either a disease or an insect is causing the issue. But the location on the fruit is the telltale sign.
So, go ahead, Jesse.
Oh, I was just going to say, fruits with blossom end rot are typically still going to be mostly edible as long as you cut out the rotting part. So you're not going to suffer a total fruit loss from a blossom end rot issue like you would with other disease issues. So that's a little bit of good news when it comes to dealing with this particular disorder.
We're speaking with Jesse Gilmore from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. He's a horticulture agent. And Jesse, anything else as far as tomatoes that you're seeing or maybe that we should kind of keep on our radar as we head into August and kind of the later summer months?
Well, some people have called, not necessarily into the later summer months because this is a problem that's already happened, but some people will have called in the past couple of weeks with one of two leaf diseases, either early blight or septoria leaf spot. Those diseases need to be controlled very early in the growing season with a fungicide in order to prevent them from taking out entire plants. Early blight in particular can be a destructive plant problem where it's going to turn a lot of the plant crispy very quick around the beginning of July. And there's nothing you can really do once you start seeing symptoms of it. So preventative spraying around the early, middle June is going to be necessary with something like a copper fungicide or chlorothalonil. there's a lot of different fungicide options for controlling this particular disease. But early prevention is key to making sure that you have pretty healthy tomato plants coming into July.
Gotcha. And Jesse, while you're here, I wanted to ask you the question because I've been noticing it a lot. What I'm seeing, what I assume are the bagworms that are hanging down on the thread, you know, from trees all over the place. Is that what is coming out here that we're seeing everywhere?
Yep. So bagworms are really active right now. I went out to a house last week. I think it was last week. And their sweet gum tree was completely defoliated. Like there was nothing left but the stems of the leaves on the tree. It was kind of eerie. And they were just all up and down this particular tree. Now, defoliation, one time for deciduous trees like that, typically not going to kill the tree. But if it happens year after year, you will need to control the bagworms before the resources in the tree get wiped out, trying to regrow any foliage. Once they're in their bags, you can't really spray for contact control because the bags protect the worms. So you're going to need to spray a residue insecticide like spinosad. Much easier to do on evergreens because typically evergreens stay a lot smaller than deciduous trees. But with enough repeated incidents, deciduous trees would need to be sprayed too. And most tree services would be able to do that. Spinosad is nice in that it leaves a residue on the foliage. So any bagworm that goes up and tries to feed on the foliage will ingest the residue and die.
Now, as far as the actual worms themselves, you know, I've seen one, the ones that are just like a single strand coming down and you just see a little bag, you know, the tang in there. Then I've also seen where it looks like there's a giant nest in the tree and you can actually kind of see through this, almost see through, almost looks like a spider web and there's a bunch of worms and stuff running around in there. Are those the same thing or are they different?
Nope. Those are webworms, typically fall webworms, and they're really only going to, they are generalists. So you can see them on a bunch of different species, but in practice, when I'm out looking at trees, they affect things with lots of compound leaves. So things like honey and black locust, pecan, walnut, those are the trees we see them on the most. They are very, very minor pests when compared to bagworms. They don't get nearly up into the populations that bagworms will. So while the webs might look initially concerning, they're not something we typically recommend controlling.
Yeah, no, they do look a little scary there, but hey, that's good news. So, Jesse, if people do have questions for you and they're seeing something that they need a little help on, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Phone 620-724-8233 for the Girard office or email jr637@ksu.edu.
All right. Well, Jesse, we really appreciate you coming on, and hope you have a good rest of your day and rest of your weekend. Look forward to talking again here real soon.
Yeah, you too. Stay cool.
Yeah, you good luck out there. All right, that is Jesse Gilmore, K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District here on the Mighty 690. And we're just minutes away from our chat with James Coover. He will be talking some ancient grains. That's coming up here on the Mighty 690. 78 degrees right now in Coffeyville, and we're heading up to a high today right around 100. Good morning. Coming up on 810 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time to continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. On the line, we have Crop Agent James Coover. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, doing good. How are you?
Doing well. Good to have you on here. So,
very good to be there in person.
Hey, that's okay. That's why we have the phone. So that's good stuff. So, we've got a couple events I know as far as Wildcat District events going on that you want to hit on. So what do we have coming up?
So Whitney actually has a beef cattle and forage field day that's coming up at the Southeast Research Center in Parsons. And that'll be on August the 3rd. And so looking at the lineup of this field day, it's going to be awesome. Like, they have great speakers all day long. Registration starts at 8:30. And then they're going to talk about all kinds of various forage things. The Economist is coming out of Oklahoma, and they're going to talk about, you know, that part of it. They're also going to talk about ticks and flies and pasture management and culling cows and feeding strategies and all sorts of other stuff. If I didn't have the Crawford County Fair, I would totally be there for this one because this looks like an awesome field day. But I'm going to send my dad because he's, you know, very interested in this stuff. So, but it'll be on August the 3rd at the Research Center in Parsons at 8:30.
Hey, that's some good stuff. I know county fairs keeping all of us busy. Hey, as you've been driving around and that sort of thing, how are the different crops looking? I know corn's getting pretty darn tall and tasseling, yeah. All that good stuff.
Yeah, the corn, you know, it's about as done as it's going to get. And so it's green filling for the most part is done. You know, I'm assuming a lot of it probably has a black layer, which means it's where it's cut it off and it's starting to dry down now, which is why it kind of looks like the way it does. The drought didn't really help it too much. Some places got way more rain than others, and so the yields are going to be all over the place this year in corn. I mean, it's just going to be good spots and bad spots all throughout the district. The soybeans, they're insanely resilient. Soybeans are an amazing plant, and so they can just sit there and be droughty for a long time. It's not good for them by any means, but those can just sit there and just do nothing for a while and wait for the next rain. And so that's sort of what they're doing right now. They're just growing a little bit every time it rains, and hopefully when we get into the full, I mean, they're already flowering now, so hopefully when we get into the green filling, we get a little more rain and they'll finish up. So,
hey, that's some good stuff. So we'll keep an eye on that. But yeah, like you said, it probably gonna be all over the place. So yeah, that's our luck this year. So hey, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about the term ancient grains, and to me, you know, that seems like it's some sort of marketing thing. But
yeah.
Can you explain just a little bit of about this and what are these?
Yeah, so you're exactly right. Ancient grains, that's kind of a marketing thing. You know, you see them on some loaves of bread or something like that. And that's actually what made me think of that when I was really thinking of this topic. I saw that on a loaf of bread. Ancient grains is really a misnomer. I mean, technically there's no such thing as an ancient grain, or more practically, all grains are ancient. And so unofficially, they include certain types of like wheat, barley, oats, milo, millet. I mean, and there's also some pseudo cereals as well, like quinoa, amaranth, and buckwheat. And so all of those have been around for a very, very, very long time. Really, most of them like predate humans, actually. We've just cultured them to be more productive. And so, you know, we've selectively bred them over thousands of years to turn them into what crops they are now. And so, I mean, corn actually doesn't quite fit into that category, but comes pretty close. And so the creation of wheat, as we know, is believed, the creation of, like, even specifically wheat, is back from, like, ancient Mesopotamians, and that's how old that one is. And so, like, an domestic wheat genetics are crazy. It's actually, like, three sets of chromosomal pairs, and so the DNA is three times that of humans, in a way. And so, you know, a lot of these crops have a very long history, and they're way more complex than what we can really think of. And so, but really, all of our grains on this list, they're all ancient in these terms, anyway.
So, you know, it really comes down to ancient grains are fairly common, I guess.
Yeah, so really, most grains that we eating are ancient. And so, I mean, like Cheerios, for instance, they're made with oats, and oats are an ancient grain. And Milo, I mean, that's one of the most common, well, sorghum in some places, Milo here, is one of the most common grains in the world, really, and that's been around in Africa for thousands of years as well. And so millet is pretty common grain in some parts of the world, and grows a lot like Milo does, really. And so, I mean, we used to grow quite a bit of millet here in Kansas, and that's also one of those considered ancient grains that you'll sometimes see part of the marketing, you know, millet. But it used to be a pretty common commercial crop here.
So what happened? Why did it stop?
Just, you know, every new grain requires a new production line. And so, I mean, if we were to bring millet back, there would have to be, you know, bins at the co-op for millet. There would have to be a marketing place for millet. It's all about what you can sell.
And see, the only millet that I...
We can grow millet here, for sure. We can grow beautiful millet, but we have to have a place to take it.
The only millet that I'm, you know, used to is the stuff that feed the parakeets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what most people see it. But, you know, if you look around, like, some of the, you know, like Kind bars and things like that, you'll see millet inside of those. Yeah, and it's just a It's like Milo, and only it's smaller.
So. Interesting. Well, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about pseudo-cereals, and what the heck is that?
Yeah, so pseudo-cereals. So pseudo-cereals, it's kind of an odd term. It's a non-grass crop. So basically, it's a, you know, it's a dicot. It's, you know, not a broadleaf. I mean, yeah, usually broadleaf. And so we use in the same way as a cereal crop. And so, like I mentioned before, quinoa, amaranth, and buckwheat, these are all probably the most common pseudo-cereals that we normally eat, and they're all broadleaf, and they produce a seed that we can ground into a flour, or, you know, crush up and eat crushed. And so, you know, corn, milo, wheat, rice are big crops. They're all grass. And so soybean, canola, and most sunflower broadleaves are all oil crops, meaning they have a high amount of protein, they have a high amount of oil. We don't have very many grains that are both broadleaves, but they're not oil crops. There are a few sunflowers, but besides these pseudo-cereals, there's really not a whole lot of broadleaves that we grow that are within that category, that are non-oil crops. And so that's kind of just a place where pseudo-cereals can fit in. This is kind of a futuristic idea of ag, like growing different crops than what we do now. And so pseudo-cereals, it's sometimes considered like superfoods because they have complex amino acids profiles that are usually different from the grains, of course. Most of them have like a higher level of protein. They have an incredibly high vitamin content. And so it's just one of those things that kind of complements a lot of the grain crops that we grow now because it fills in the gaps, nutritionally speaking, that we sometimes don't do very well of. Honestly. And so the way that I see this is that ideally in the future, even though these crops have been around for thousands of years, ideally in the future we'll see a lot more of this stuff baked into our baked goods. And so like when you're buying, I don't know, Hostess cakes of some kind or whatever, there'll be some content of pseudo grains. That way you can get a more complex amino acid profile and vitamin content. Within the various breads and other things that we, cookies and things that we make, because you're blending those flours together of all those different grains.
Well, that is really interesting. And you and I must have been on the same wavelength this morning or whatever, because I came up with our Coffeeville Coffee Company quest in the day, and it's actually about bread. It's like, do you prefer white bread versus wheat bread? Because I was trying to think about that because, you know, white bread has really kind of gotten a bad rap here lately, just being some people calling it like nutritionally inert and that sort of thing, far as, you know, just not having a lot of, you know, value. I know they do fortify it, but still, you know, yeah, you compare it, being able to blend some of the stuff in it. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah. And so, you know, of course, all bread is wheat bread, but the only difference is that they don't take off the brand on wheat bread.
Yeah.
Or,
right. It's
true. The brand is the most healthy part. And so it's kind of funny that we separate the bran and the germ from the wheat, and humans eat the wheat and cows eat the bran. We feed the healthiest part to the cattle. So
yeah,
I don't know.
It's bizarre. But yeah, you do have a good point that all bread comes from wheat. It's just how it's kind of labeled and marketed and, you know, 100% whole wheat, that sort of thing. But hey, as far as the, you know, these pseudo cereals, what about growing them? Are they difficult to grow, and what about the yields?
Not really. And so they're actually fairly easy to grow, and they grow around here. There's actually, most of them have some sort of wild invasive, not invasive, a wild weed that grows somewhere in this area. And so, you know, like buckwheat. I mean, buckwheat grows in our fields around here. Now, the ones that we culture, that's a different variety of buckwheat, obviously, that we can grow to produce grain. But they grow really well around here, sometimes too well. And so, like mentioned, millet, I mean, it used to be grown around here a lot, and it has yields. But they're slightly less than Milo. And so, I mean, millet, it's a pretty drought-resistant crop, and, I mean, it grows fairly quickly. And so, I mean, it can be grown in a lot of short time frames, too. And so that's what, like with most of these, is just you're going to have the yields are generally smaller just because they haven't been cultured the way that others have to have that massive production. And so amaranth is just a weed by another name. And so cultured amaranth is like a variety of pigweed. So you imagine pigweeds out in our soybean fields or all that. You can actually, there's some varieties of amaranth, like Palmer amaranth, that have big enough seeds that we can actually harvest. In some places in the world, they do. They grow Palmer amaranth, a different kind, and they harvest that stuff for seed. And so, I mean, and like I was saying with buckwheat, it grows incredibly quickly. And so, I mean, you're not getting but 20, 30 bushels a year with buckwheat. But you're growing it kind of in a different way. And so also, cultured buckwheat is different than the wild buckwheat but that we see in our wheat fields. But still, I mean, you know, all this stuff, it grows incredibly well around here. And so, you know, yeah, we can do it all. It's just a matter of where do we take it, where do we market it.
Well, sure.
Is there a place to do it?
And, I mean, obviously it would be a long haul, and I know relations aren't the best right now, but, you know, buckwheat's a huge deal in Russia and, you know, Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. That's like their cereal, which is so much different than, you know, what we're used to here.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, you know, if you think about the things that we grow are the same things that they grow in that area. I mean, because the climate's very similar. And so we're growing almost a lot of the exact same stuff. And so, I mean, it's surprising, really, that even some of the crops that would grow better here, they grow in different countries, just because that's culturally normal for them to eat it, actually. So I don't know. I mean, there is definitely a place for us to fit, to cram other little crops within our rotations, if there was a place to take it, honestly. I also want to mention kernza. Kernza has always been interesting to me. It's a perennial wheat, which means it's a wheat that you don't replant every year. You plant it once, and you harvest it for 5-6 years. Eventually, it will kind of kill itself out, like a lot of these kinds of crops, kind of like alfalfa. And so you plant it once, and then you continue to harvest.
Man, that sounds fantastic.
It does, yeah. And so wheat is not genetically weird. And so there's all kinds of wheats, and they cross with each other not all the time, but wheats can cross with each other and create various diploid and haploid and all sorts of stuff. And so what kernza is kind of going back to more of that ancient wheat and using that perennial nature that wheat normally would have had to create a crop. And what it was actually developed in Kansas at the Land Institute in Salina. And so the yield is lower, I mean, because it's a perennial crop, but it's a constant cover crop. And so you plant it once, and it covers the soil for the entire year. It can actually be grazed in the fall and in the spring. Eventually, you have to take the cattle off when it starts to, you know, make a seed head. But in that way, it's a lot like fescue, actually, in the way that it kind of grows. And we can graze it. The idea behind kernza is that it's mostly about soil protection, but also getting some sort of grain crop. And I've seen yields on it before. I mean, it's probably half of what wheat is, which is not great. And the kernel is different. It's more like the ancient wheat kernel, and so it's a really hard husk on it. The way that, you know, and you can actually take that kernza and you can turn it into flour, bread, I mean, pretty much everything that you can turn wheat into, it has a higher protein content. And so it's a little more like, you know, what we call whole wheat bread. I mean, that's kind of what kernza bread ends up looking a lot more like. The way that I see it being used is for cattle operations, actually. Around in this area would be perfect. We have lots of smaller cattle operations where we plant this stuff. We throw our cows out there for a lot of the year. We take our cows off, and then we harvest that grain, and then we feed that grain back to the cattle. We crush it up. We feed that grain back to the cattle during the winter when they need that high protein content and all those other more complex stuff that they're not getting from the hay during the winter months. And so I see it fitting within our cattle operations in this area really well, actually. So, you know, but it's getting there. Kernza really is. It's something that we'll likely see more of in the future. Seed's hard to get a hold of right now, just because a lot of it's still in research. It's being bred and developed by multiple state colleges now. And so K-State's been looking at it. There's a few northern states that colleges that are also breeding this stuff. And so it's really coming along, and I'm hoping to see more of it in the future.
Hey, that is really neat, and especially, you know, as we go through, you know, all these challenges as far as water and things go, you know, people are going to have to get a little bit more creative in their production, and, you know, this sounds like it could be a great move, especially for some of these smaller operators. So appreciate you bringing that to our attention, and it's funny, I've actually been to the Land Institute there in Salina, so it's funny you bring that up. It's kind of a cool place. All righty. Well, James, if people do have any questions for you and crop-related or otherwise, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, you can give me a call. The number for the Girard office is 620-724-8233. And if people are interested in the Beef Cattle Forage Field Day on August the 3rd, you can give the Southeast Center a call. Call Allie at 620-820-6127. Or just call any of the Wildcat offices, and we can make that work, too.
All righty. Well, James, appreciate you coming on the program this morning, and hope you have a great rest of your week. Look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thank you so much.
All right, you take care. That is Crop Agent James Coover here on the Mighty 690. We appreciate him calling in. And, of course, we have the folks from K-State Research and Extension on every Wednesday at 7:40 and 8:10. Coming up, we do have an early bird edition of Open Line here in just a couple of minutes, followed by Candy Westbrook. She'll be in at 9:10, so we'll take a quick break from Open Line. Be back before you know it here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. 79 degrees right now as we head towards a forecast high of 102.